Hello. Thank you for listening to this Nutrition and Clinical Practice podcast. My name is David Evans. And I am a trauma critical care surgeon and nutrition support specialist at Ohio Health Grant Medical Center in Columbus, Ohio, and adjunct clinical professor of surgery at Ohio University. I am also the guest author for a Nutrition and Clinical Practice supplement on fat malabsorption in disease states published in April 2024. Today, we are discussing fat malabsorption and short bowel syndrome, a review of pathophysiology and therapeutics. This was one of the papers featured in the supplemental issue of NCP focusing on fat malabsorption, a collection of papers from leading scientists discussing various clinical aspects of fat malabsorption and our newest clinical understanding of the impact, diagnosis, and treatment. Today, I welcome Dr. Savas Sikas, one of the authors of the above-mentioned article. Dr. Sikas is a surgical resident at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and Harvard Medical School in Boston. He has been working in the laboratory of Dr. Mark Puder at Boston Children's Hospital, where they conduct research focused on pediatric short bowel syndrome, the roles of both parenteral and enteral lipids on short bowel syndrome, and PNALD, and more recently have been investigating the impact of fat malabsorption on their patients with short bowel syndrome and developing treatment strategies to address fat malabsorption and improve outcomes. Before we start, I want to share disclosures with our listening audience. This podcast and the production of this NCP supplement was financially supported in part by a grant from Alcresta Therapeutics, which had no involvement in the editorial decisions, content, or writing of the supplement or this podcast. As a personal disclosure, I have previously received speaking and consulting honoraria from Alcresta. Thank you for joining me, Savas. Do you have any disclosures on this topic that you would like to share?
Thank you, Dr. Evans, for the kind introduction. As a disclosure, I have previously received salary support and research funding from Alcresta Therapeutics for the purpose of research.
I think many clinicians are familiar with the concept of short bowel syndrome, or we may call it SBS today, leading to malabsorption. And typically, we associate it with decreased intestinal surface area and fast transit. But in the article, you really go into depth about several mechanisms. Can you tell us about those?
Of course. In the review, we delve into the proposed mechanisms that lead to fat malabsorption and short bowel syndrome, with a focus on harnessing this pathophysiology for the development of future targeted therapeutics. One needs to understand that the critical components for fat digestion and absorption include pancreatic enzymes, bile salts, formation of micelles, a sufficient number of enterocyte apical membrane protein receptors, and then having enough surface area for absorption and an intact underlying intestinal motility. In short bowel syndrome, several of these key processes are altered, resulting in the underlying pathophysiology. First, you have inadequate surface area and altered intestinal motility, which limits the interaction between pancreatic lipase and lipid droplets necessary for fat digestion. This means that by the time the biochemical reactions necessary for fat absorption have occurred, the fat has already entered the colon or the ostomy bag in some of our patients, and therefore it's not absorbed. In addition, increased gastric acid secretion in SBS is also thought to contribute, as it can alter the function of pancreatic enzymes as well as bile salts. From an anatomical perspective, both the jejunum and ileum, which are frequently resected in SBS patients, can play key roles in fat absorption and the intrahepatic circulation of bile salts. Bile acid malabsorption further compromises the ability to form micelles, thus impairing fat absorption. Ultimately, the combination of these mechanisms results in the malabsorption of fats, and along with them, essential fatty acids and fat-soluble vitamins, which ultimately contributes to ongoing dependence on parenteral nutrition, micronutrient deficiencies, liver disease, and an inability to achieve enteral autonomy.
Great. Your group has been doing both animal and human trials trying to optimize fat absorption. I understand that trials of oral pancreatic enzymes for short bowel syndrome have had mixed results at best. You studied the impact of enteral feeding. Which type of enteral feeding do you recommend for these patients? And which did you study? Why do you recommend it? And tell us how you use the immobilized lipase in a cartridge form to hydrolyze the triglycerides into glycerol and free fatty acids prior to delivery.
Yes, oral pancreatic enzymes have been evaluated previously in phase 2 clinical trials for short bowel syndrome, and there was no statistically significant improvement in enteral fat absorption in these trials. The reason we hypothesize that oral enzymes do not appear to work in SBS, we think makes sense when one considers the underlying physiology. Fat malabsorption in short bowel syndrome, unlike in other disease states like cystic fibrosis, is not due to a deficiency in pancreatic lipase, but as mentioned previously, is related to the combination of decreased intestinal length and altered intestinal motility. Therefore, by simply ingesting oral pancreatic enzymes, either with meals or with the provision of enteral nutrition, it does not address this underlying pathophysiology. As such, we thought to tackle the problem with a different approach. Considering that many SBS patients require supplemental enteral formula to meet their nutritional needs, we hypothesized that by pre-digesting fats in enteral formula before reaching the patient, we would be able to bypass these rate-limiting steps that contribute to fat malabsorption in SBS. This is where that immobilized lipase cartridge comes in. This cartridge, which is manufactured by Alcresta Therapeutics, connects in line with existing enteral tube feeding sets and contains immobilized lipase that efficiently hydrolyzes the various triglycerides in enteral formula in an active fashion and a continuous fashion as the formula is being pumped into the patient. The cartridge was originally designed for disease states like cystic fibrosis, but we thought to adapt it for SBS based on this exact understanding of the pathophysiology. By hydrolyzing the triglycerides, this allows for the ingestion of digested free fatty acids that can then be readily absorbed, thereby bypassing the issue of decreased intestinal length and function that we see in short bowel syndrome specifically.
Much of your group's work has been done in piglet intestinal resection models. Can you tell us about this model and some of the similarities or differences when compared to humans? What challenges have you encountered with the model?
Yeah, of course. We have done several studies investigating fat malabsorption in an established Yorkshire piglet SBS model. In this model, SBS is surgically induced by resecting 75% of the distal jejunum and ileum. After recovery, animals are maintained on a combination of enteral nutrition and PN. We chose this model as the piglet intestinal anatomy, despite some differences, shares key similarities both developmentally and functionally to humans. Furthermore, the SBS piglet animal model is well studied in the literature and was used in the initial investigations of GLP-2 analogs, which are now used as therapeutics in short bowel syndrome. Importantly, in our initial work, we also confirmed that like in human SBS, these animals do develop fat malabsorption and deficiencies of fat-soluble vitamins. In terms of the challenges, I could spend the entire podcast discussing these challenges as we worked on optimizing the model. It is very hard to convey how much time went into both the planning and execution of these studies. As an example, we had to build our own enteral formula delivery system, as there was nothing reported in the literature that allowed for at least partial preventing of the twisting that of the tubing that would go into the animals. And this allowed for us to deliver nutrition continuously, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We also encountered some difficulties in the postoperative management of these piglets. They recover differently than humans. They present with complications differently than humans. And we even had a call schedule. We rotated amongst ourselves, watching these animals 24 hours a day. And because we had these initial difficulties and we didn't really have a good paper to base it off of when we were designing our trials, we did publish a methods paper, so potentially help future investigators who are delving into this adventure. But ultimately, going back to your original question, we were able to evaluate the immobilized lipase cartridge that I discussed previously in this preclinical animal model, and through several studies demonstrated that its use with enteral nutrition improved both the absorption of fat and fat-soluble vitamins, and also reduced PN dependence in the second trial. This work led the foundation for our future human clinical trials.
I thought it was really interesting reading about the model and the work you did there. Thank you. Now you are doing human trials. What population are you studying? Can you tell us how you've designed those trials, what the endpoints of those are, and perhaps give us an update on how those are going?
For our clinical trials, we have two ongoing. We are recruiting pediatric patients who have short bowel syndrome and are on enteral feeds and are also dependent on parenteral nutrition, as this is the specific population we are interested in studying. These trials were designed based on the results of our initial preclinical studies with the immobilized lipase cartridge. And in terms of their trial design, since SBS is a rare disease with a wide degree of heterogeneity amongst the various patients, our phase 3 clinical trial has both a pre and post study design where each subject effectively serves as their own control. The duration of the first trial is 90 days, and then patients who complete the initial 90-day trial have the option of participating in a voluntary additional 90-day extension study to study the effects of the cartridge for a longer period of time. In both studies, the primary outcome is the change from baseline and PN calories, and secondary outcomes include the change in body weight, using weight for age-adjusted Z-scores, and change in fat and fat-soluble vitamins. The trials are ongoing. We are planning on enrolling 32 patients over 4 years. And while I cannot discuss any specific outcomes, as the studies are still ongoing, the results are thus far encouraging. And we are in the process of recruiting additional sites to expedite patient enrollment.
Great. In this paper, you mentioned it briefly, but I see you've written at least two other papers about targeting free fatty acid receptors in the liver. You know, our readership normally thinks of free fatty acids as a source of nutrition. And while there are some commonly recognized beneficial fatty acids like EPA and DHA, the concept of fatty acid receptors is not something that is top of mind in daily clinical practice. You propose that these receptors play a significant role, particularly in liver disease associated with short bowel and parenteral nutrition. Can you tell us a little bit about this and why it's important?
Yes, I would say it's a very interesting concept in terms of free fatty acid receptors, and this is an ongoing active area investigation by not just us, but also others. There's emerging data to suggest that free fatty acids play important roles in developmental and normal intestinal and liver physiology. And that goes beyond the already known nutritional benefits of omega-3 fatty acids like EPA, DHA, especially in relation to their anti-inflammatory effects. For example, we have specifically investigated the role of a structural engineered fatty acid, which is a strong antagonist with a nuclear receptor protein known as PPAR-alpha, and this has known anti-inflammatory effects. We have demonstrated that oral administration of this fatty acid analog ameliorates liver disease in short bowel syndrome and associated with the use of parenteral nutrition in neonatal piglets. As a result of this initial work, this is also being considered and investigated in human phase 2 clinical trials. I think given the ubiquitous expression of intestinal fatty acid receptors, it's not surprising that the presence of fatty acids may help also intestinal adaptation in SBS. In fact, going back to our initial preclinical trials evaluating the immobilized lipase cartridges, we even demonstrated increased intestinal growth and adaptation in animals that were randomized to the cartridge group. And we posited that this was directly related to the positive intestinotrophic effects of free fatty acids by potentially binding through those receptors. Studies by others in mice and rats have also demonstrated similar findings, and as such is, I think, a very interesting area of ongoing research.
Many of our readers are probably not familiar with the farcinoid X receptor or the drugs that are designed to target it. Can you give us a little extra background on that receptor and why you see it as a therapeutic target and what we should be looking for to come out in the future?
As our understanding of the complex physiology involved in fat absorption improves, new therapeutics are emerging to target these various pathways. And as you mentioned, the farcinoid X receptor, which controls metabolism of fatty acids and glucose, is just one such example. Bile acids bind to FXR and have been shown to confer hepatoprotective effects. As such, patients who have short bowel syndrome, who have impaired recycling of bile acids, have decreased activation of FXR, which may in turn partially contribute to cholestatic liver disease, which is a major complication of ongoing PN dependence. Agonists targeting this pathway can therefore be beneficial. That being said, I think one always has to consider any new drug and its potential side effects. And considering this, I still think the initial emphasis should always be placed on the more benign interventions and then having a graduated approach. For example, starting with simply changing the lipid formulation to a hepatoprotective one, such as fish oil, and then, as I said, going on a step-up approach to a more advanced therapeutics.
Thanks for that. In the article, you go into detail to explain the coefficient of fat absorption as a high-quality test of fat malabsorption. When I'm talking to clinicians, they often lament the challenges of diagnosis. There are a lot of inconsistencies in diagnostic protocols. It seems your group has figured this out pretty well. Could you explain the test that you do and how you incorporated the testing into your practice? Should other clinicians consider adopting that test?
I think this is a very important concept, so thank you for bringing it up. Malabsorption of fat is the most commonly used indicator of global malabsorption, as it tends to be a little bit more sensitive compared to other macronutrients such as proteins and carbohydrates. And as you mentioned, there's a wide variety of approaches for diagnosing fat malabsorption, either in a 24-hour collection, spot fecal fat checks, fecal elastase, and so on and so forth. The generally accepted gold standard, especially in our patient population, tends to be the what is known as the coefficient of fat absorption, also known as the CFA. To determine and calculate the CFA, 72-hour period of monitoring is necessary. During the 72-hour period, all intake, both oral and enteral feeds, are recorded by the patient or their family. And during that time period, all stool is collected in containers for further testing. From this data, we then are able to determine how much fat the patient's ingested during the 72-hour period, and also determine the total fat output by measuring the total amount of fat present in the stool. The CFA then represents the percentage of fat that is ultimately absorbed during that time period. And while it can be cumbersome, because you need to pay very close attention to all ingestion during that time, as well as collect all the stool during the same time period, given the day-to-day variations, it does appear to provide the most accurate information and can be useful both in preclinical and clinical studies of fat malabsorption. That's what we have the most experience with, both in our preclinical studies as well as our clinical studies. An emerging test that I think is becoming more and more interesting, but one which we do not personally have experience with yet, is known as the malabsorption blood test, or MBT. And in this test, patients are fed essentially a standardized meal containing pentadecanoic acid or triheptadecanoic acid, and then plasma samples are obtained over 8 hours. Pentadecanoic acid is absorbed without digestion, while triheptadecanoic acid requires hydrolysis. And therefore, by looking at this differential absorption between these two fatty acids, you can get an idea of fat malabsorption that is specific to the lack of pancreatic lipase in digestion. And while this is very interesting, and it's been increasingly used for patients who have documented pancreatic insufficiency, it has not yet been validated in the SBS patient population specifically. And as such, we elected to not use it for our clinical trials. And it's for this exact reason that we elected to do the gold standard, which is the 72-hour stool collection. In terms of the spot fecal fat testing, I think more and more clinicians are moving away from it as it has issues with reliability and validity. And it's for this exact reason we avoided its use in our studies. And then as an additional test, I think we also mentioned the fecal elastase 1, which measures the elastase that's secreted by the pancreas and can also be indicative of exocrine pancreatic insufficiency. But as the pathophysiology, as we discussed previously, of fat malabsorption in SBS is more related to factors such as intestinal dysmotility and intestinal surface area, the fecal elastase 1 may be less reliable in this particular patient population.
Thanks for sharing all that. A great review of the different testing options. I'll be really interested to see how things evolve with the malabsorption blood test and the comparison of the hydrolyzed versus the non-hydrolyzed fat as time goes on. I think that may be an interesting development in this field. Thank you, Savas, for sharing your expertise with our listeners. I invite our listeners to learn more about fat malabsorption, its impact, and treatment by reading the collection of articles on this topic in the 2024 Supplement of Nutrition and Clinical Practice. I also want to thank Alcresta Therapeutics for their financial support of this NCP supplement. As we conclude, I want to remind you to share this podcast and other NCP podcasts with your nutrition support colleagues. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Savas.
Thank you.